So we are on the tail end. This is the last week of a series that we have entitled What Love Does. And in this series, if you're like coming in for the first time or you've been away for a bit, we can get you caught up really quickly. It's not that complicated. We've simply been building this entire series on one statement that Jesus made. One statement where Jesus calls us to live into a particular virtue, where Jesus tells us that how we treat each other tells a story about who we are. Jesus simply said, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you're my disciples if you love one another." And so in the first week of the series, we talked about how Jesus was saying that the hallmark of his church should be their exceptional love for one another. That the way we treat each other should be one of the most compelling things about what we believe. That the way we love each other should cause a culture that might be critical of what we believe to be envious of what we have. And so all series long, then we've just been asking, okay, if that's the case, then what does that kind of love look like? What specifically do we need to do as we interact with each other to follow what Jesus is telling us here? What is it that love does? And in each week, we've looked at a different facet of love. We put love under the microscope and just tried to figure out, okay, what does this look like for us to do? Now, as we wrap this up this week, we are going to look at arguably the most well-known passage from the New Testament on the concept of love. It's one that the Apostle Paul wrote. And just to get us going, we'll have a pop quiz here at church. Everybody ready? All right. Thank you. All right. If you answer me when I ask a question, it makes me think you're listening. Even if you're not, it builds my self-esteem. All right? So here we go. Most, if you go, hey, this is the passage from the New Testament on love most people are going to be familiar with, what would it be? John 3:16 is a good one. It's not the one I have in mind. 1 Corinthians, that's right. 1 Corinthians 13. You get an extra cookie today. You fellowship hall, all right? All right, so 1 Corinthians 13. Chances are, if somebody's going to know a passage from the New Testament love, they're going to know it's that one. Now, they may not know that's the address or the reference, but that's the one they're familiar with. In fact, if somebody's going to hear that passage quoted to them and it's not Sunday morning at church, where's the most likely place for it to happen? A wedding. That's where you all get a cookie. Congratulations, right? Now, hopefully they made enough and I'm not a liar. So it's going to be at a wedding. It's going to be at a wedding. And here's the funny thing, though. You know, 1 Corinthians 13 isn't talking about marriage. It's not. And don't get me wrong, I'm not against people quoting it at weddings. I've quoted and preached from it at weddings. There's nothing wrong with that. But technically, Paul isn't talking about marriage in 1 Corinthians 13. He's talking to the Corinthian church about how they treat each other. In fact, the whole book, for the most part, he just keeps coming back to these different examples of how they treat each other, and he keeps calling them to something higher. And in 13, he's calling them specifically to love better. And then he starts to talk about some of the things that love does. Now, here's the interesting thing about this passage. On the front end of the passage, the things that Paul's talking about, they make sense, they're logical. You're like, yeah, I get that. I can see how that would help my relationships, my marriage, my friendships, my people I go to church with across the board. But then at the end of that statement, he starts saying some things about love that if you think about them beyond a surfacey kind of level, they're a little bit disconcerting. Like you'll look at it and you go, you know, when I think about that, I don't know. Like, I get the Bible is supposed to be God's good truth for my life, but the advice Paul seems to be giving me here, I'm not sure if this is a good idea. And yet, I would contend with you, it's a great idea. A great idea. But you got to dig a little bit beneath the surface. Let me try and illustrate what I'm talking about here. So Paul begins 1 Corinthians 13. He says, love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. So you go, okay, if I'm patient, I'm kind, I'm not rude, I'm not big-headed, that would be good for my relationships. Everybody probably agree on that. He continues. He says, It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrong. So, you know, love isn't going to be rude. Love isn't going to be selfish. Love isn't going to get hysterical. Love isn't going to get historical, all right? Again, every one of those things, we can go, that'd be good for my relationships. He says next, he says, love does not delight in evil, but it rejoices with the truth. So, you know, love is going to celebrate the wins. It's not going to camp out on the losses. And then he says, about love, it always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Or the New American Standard translates it this way. It says, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Now, on a surfacey kind of level, you're like, okay, what's the big deal? I'm telling you, when you think about what Paul is saying here beneath the surface, you start to dig into it, it'll create some cognitive dissonance. For example, if you would, I want you to bring to mind somebody in your life, maybe even somebody in your church, who you find to be difficult to love. Maybe what they say, maybe what they don't say, maybe how they say it, what they do, what they don't do, whatever it is. Who do you have in your life, if you're just honest, they're tough to love? Now look at a person next to you and tell them their name. I'm kidding, don't do that, all right? Especially if they're the person, all right? You know, have a fight, it was you, you know, don't do that, all right? Seriously, who's a person that's difficult to love? Now, with that person in mind, hear Paul. He's saying love is always going to protect that person. Love is always going to trust them. It's always going to hope in them. It's always going to persevere with them. That person, love wants you to bear all things, believe all things, hope all things, endure all things with that person. Anybody feeling the rub a little bit there, right? I mean, like if love believes all things, does that mean love's blind? Because some of us thought of people who don't always tell the truth, do they, right? And if love always perseveres, if love always endures, could that be a recipe for dysfunctional enablement? You know, like what about confrontation? What about hard conversations? What about accountability? What about boundaries? Or if love always trusts, if love always hopes, what about reality? What about the person who isn't worthy of trust? Like, you start digging beneath the surface of what Paul is saying here. It's like, I don't know. I'm not sure that would be good for my relationships. And yet I would contend that what Paul is talking about here is incredibly powerful and incredibly good for our relationships. You just got to think about it. You got to dig even deeper. See, what I think Paul is doing here, he's using the word always four times. That's not that tricky. It's right up there in black and white. But he's using the word always, and he attaches it to four different words, four similar concepts. I think he's saying the same thing four times over. That's not uncommon in literature in his day, to try and make one point about what love does. Now, to help us wrap our brains around that, what I want to do is kind of take a step back from the biblical passage and try and illustrate this facet of love I think Paul's getting after. And then after we've illustrated it, take a step back up to the biblical passage and see if that illustration helps draw some of the meaning out. So, in every one of our relationships, we've got three things, right? We've got expectations. Every relationship you have expectations about another person. That's not a bad thing. It's just part of how relationships work. They come from different places. They might come, the person told you they were going to do something, you expect them to do it. You know, you maybe told them to do something and you expect them to do it, or maybe just the role that they have in the relationship creates certain expectations. They're not necessarily wrong. They can be healthy, they can be unhealthy, but they're just part of relationships. We have expectations. Now, in every relationship, in addition to expectations, we have performance. Expectations, this is what I expect you to do. Performance is what you actually do. And in every relationship, sooner or later, we have the gap. Now, the gap comes into play when expectations are here and performance is there. When someone's performance doesn't meet your expectations of them, you get the gap, right? So, like, you expected that your boss would have some kind of social skills. He's rude. He's demeaning. He's manipulative. There's the gap, right? You expected your children to clean up after themselves. I don't know why, because it's still a mess up in there. That's the gap, right? We'll be fair. Young people, you expected your parents to be a little more cool. God only knows why. I mean, have you seen the way they dress, what they do with their hair, what that comes out of their mouth, right? That's the gap, right? You expected people you go to church with to be kind and considerate, and some of them are rude and selfish. There's the gap. Now, the gap's there. When the gap comes, every time the gap is there, we fill the gap with one of two things. Every time. Either we fill the gap with believe the best, or we fill the gap with assume the worst. Sometimes we're more cognizant of it than others, but every time we fill it with one of those two things. Every time. So, it's 5:00. We're supposed to meet 4:45. He's still not here. There's the expectation, there's the performance, there's the gap. What am I going to fill that gap with? Now, I can fill the gap with believe the best. He's late. He's late again. He's always late. I know toddlers that are more responsible than this guy. I mean, it's like I got nothing better to do than to sit around and wait for him to show up. He doesn't care about me, doesn't care about my schedule, no respect for my family. This guy only thinks about himself. I can fill it with assume the worst, or I can choose to fill it with believe the best. I bet you his schedule is, he's just swimming in it. It's overflowing. I bet you he got caught in a meeting with a really difficult person. I bet he's doing everything he can to get here. He didn't like being late anymore, and I like waiting for him. I can fill it with believe the best. Well, you just asked a question. You're just trying to get this thing figured out. You're just trying to get information, right? But when she answered, like, she balled her face up, and the volume went up, and the tone got demeaning, and she got all red and nasty. There's the gap. How am I going to fill it? I can fill it with, you know what, she doesn't care about how she makes other people feel. Only person's feeling she is worried about is her own. She would just spew venom any time she feels like it. I swear to you, she rode a broom to church, right? I fill the gap with assume the worst, or I can fill the gap with believe the best. You know what? She had no idea what she looks like. She isn't aware of how she sounds. I've seen her kids. They are running out of control. She is at her wit's end. She didn't mean to come across like that. When communication doesn't happen, when a deadline isn't met, when the schedule isn't kept, whatever it is, when the gap is there, we're going to go one of two directions. We're going to fill it with something. And how we fill the gap is huge. So let me ask you, for you personally, when the gap comes, which way are you inclined to go? Because we're all inclined to go one way or another. And some of it is nurture, some of it is nature, some of it is your personality, some of it is the family you grew up in, but we're all naturally inclined to go in one direction or another. For you, which way are you inclined to go? Now, anybody want to take a wild guess at which way love would have you go? Believe the best. Thank you very much. If you said assume the worst, I'm just saying. There is a positive correlation between your dysfunctional and desirable relationships and that answer. All right? See, people who have loving, desirable relationships, they have chosen to believe the best of the people they're in relationship with. Either naturally or by force of habit, they regularly come up with a gracious and generous explanation for the gap. Either naturally, they're just wired that way. They're those positive, bubbly people who just, they just can't help themselves. Or by force of habit. They have disciplined themselves to recognize when the gap is there, and they've made a conscious decision. They are going to choose believe the best. Either naturally or by force of habit, they consistently come up with a gracious and generous response for the gap. You get a great example of this in the book, The One Thing You Need to Know, by Marcus Buckingham. Now, he in this book, he theorizes that in life, in individual disciplines, like if you can really get one thing down, that one thing will help you excel than all the other things that are related to that discipline. Now, to make this point, he quotes a research study. And the study, they study couples who have been married for 10 years or more. Couples who, how many have been married for 10 years or more? Okay, keep your hands up. Then they study couples that have good relationships. How many can still keep your hands up? I'm still. All right. So they study couples. Yeah. They study couples who are married for 10 years or more and who had loving marriages. They liked being married. They people would see them and be like, I want something like they got, right? And they were trying to figure out, is there a common factor? Is there a common denominator? And going into the study, they thought they knew what it would be. It was going to be expectation management. They figured these couples have been married for 10 years or more. They know their spouse. They know how they're going to perform. They had a realistic understanding of what their spouse was going to do and not do, and they lowered their expectations to meet the performance. That's what they figured, right? That you're going to get yourself in trouble, brother. All right, so, all right. I'm on your side, all right? So, what they discovered was just the opposite. That these couples had unrealistic views of their spouses. So they'd give the husband a test. They'd be like, okay, rate yourself. And he'd rate himself right here. And then they'd give his wife the same test, and consistently she would rate her husband higher than he rated himself. And they'd give the wife the test, and she'd rate herself right here, and consistently the husband would rate his wife higher than she rated herself. The study actually demonstrated to some extent, love is blind. Yeah. Here's one of their findings. The husband and wife who assumed that his or her spouse possessed strengths that he or she didn't think they possessed was more likely to have a strong marriage. This was their advice. They did all this research, you know, raised all this money to, you know, be able to do their research. Here's their conclusion. Find the most generous explanation for each other's behavior and then believe it. Find the most generous explanation for each other's behavior and then choose to believe it. Here's some of the things these people said about each other. Get this wife. She would say about her husband, my husband's not insensitive. He's focused. Uh-huh. There it is. He's focused, Laura. He's focused, right? The wife would say, husband would say about his wife, he'd say, get ready, Laura. My wife's not impatient. Now, my baby's intense. Yeah. The research demonstrated couples, people who have desirable, loving relationships, when they get to the gap, they fill it with something generous and gracious. They choose to believe the best. Now, let's come back to the Bible. Again, for you personally, which direction do you naturally tend to move in? What Paul is saying nearly 2,000 years ago is the same thing that research that costs people all kinds of money or tax dollars at work, right, struggled to figure out. Paul said, love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love always protects. It is looking for a way to put one in the win column for you. Love always trusts. It is looking for a generous, gracious explanation. Love always hopes. It believes in you. Love always perseveres. It is not going to give up on you until it has been proven wrong. Love believes the best. Now, this can be absolutely huge for our relationships. And here's why. Here's why. Every time we fill the gap, we do something to our relationships. And every time we fill the gap, we tell a story about who we are. Every time we fill the gap, we either build a relationship up or we tear a relationship down. Every time we fill the gap, we either point somebody to Jesus or we make ourselves out to be hypocrites. Every time. See, every time I fill the gap, I let myself go negative and I fill it with assume the worst. I do violence to that relationship. Whether I mean to or not, whether I'm aware of it or not, whether I even verbalize it or not. Because the person I'm assuming the worst of, they can tell. Like, we can naturally pick this up among each other. There's something about tone and expressions and posture. It's just, we just ooze this stuff. Think about it. Think about a time you didn't live up to somebody's expectations. They didn't have to tell you, did they? You could tell. And you could tell when they were assuming the worst. And it served to drive the two of you apart. And here's part of why. It's what it communicates. You don't even have to say the words, but every time I assume the worst of you, I'm saying to you, protection? No, I'm putting one in the loss column for you. Trust? No. You are not going to find anything generous or gracious here with me. Hope? I don't believe in you. Perseverance? I've already given up on you. Every time I let myself go to assume the worst, I'm saying to the person I'm in relationship with, no, there is not love for you here. And that can't help but drive two people apart. Now, as hard as that can be to hear, the good news is that just the opposite is true, would believe the best. See, every time we go to believe the best, when we fill the gap with that, we're saying the very opposite to somebody we're in relationship with, and that cannot help but build the relationship up. It's putting a deposit down on the relationship. Assume the worst makes a withdrawal. Believe the best makes a deposit. Every time. Because we're communicating a radically different message. And think about it. Like, if you have someone in your life who believes in you, who believes that you're better than you know yourself to be. What's that person mean to you? Yeah. Like, you find yourself wanting to live up to who they believe you are. They make you want to be a better person. You don't want to let them down. And that it draws the two of you together because every time they believe the best, they're saying to you, there's protection for you here. I'm looking to put one in the win column. There's trust for you here. You're going to get grace and generosity from me. There's hope for you. I believe in you. There's perseverance. I'm not going to give up on you. Every time you fill the gap with believe the best, you're saying to the person you're in relationship with, there's love for you here. And that can't help but draw two people together. It can't help but do it. Love. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Now, before we close, let me deal with some objections. And I know they're out there, and I'm not picking on you with these, because these are in my head, all right? And so if you feel guilty because you're like, I have that objection, I feel guilty, I'm right there with you, we can be guilty together, all right? Some of us are going, okay, I see how believe the best would be good. I just don't know if I can do that. Like, I am such an assume the worst kind of person. You know, maybe it's my personality, maybe it's my parents' fault, I don't know, but like this whole believe the best thing, I just don't know that I can do that. And I would contend to you, yes, you can. It's there. You may not realize it, but it's there. And most of us here in this room, we've done it. Who in this room has been in a romantic relationship at some point in time in their life? Show of hands, all right? You remember how you acted when that relationship was brand new? Yeah. Yeah, no, nobody could tell you anything bad about that person. Not your friends, certainly not your parents, right? Not your coworkers, not your teachers, nothing. It's why the song goes the way it does. When a man loves a woman, right? Uh-huh. If she's bad, he can't see it. She can do no wrong. Turn his back on his best friend just for putting her down. Like, I can remember when my wife and I first started dating. Our relationship was moving at an alarmingly fast pace. All right, give you some context. We were dating for a month when we decided to get married. Uh-huh. What? Right? We waited 2 more months before we told everybody so they wouldn't freak out. And they freaked out. They're like, what are you guys doing? Right? And so I had one friend who cared enough and had enough courage to sit down and go, hey, can we take a step back and look at this and think about the pros and the cons and the rate and the pace? And today, I look back and I really appreciate that. Then, he was wasting his breath and my time, right? I was Twitter-pated. Couldn't nobody tell me anything but the best about my Laura, you know? Here's the thing, though. People who have loving relationships, they learn to do intentionally what they once did instinctively. It's in there. You know how to do this. But sometimes we have to get intentional about it. And so you're going to go, hey, I am going to do the work to discipline myself to recognize when the gap is there. Now, that's a dangerous thing. Because if I don't recognize the gap, then I have the excuse, well, I didn't even realize it was there, and I just naturally did this thing, I wasn't thinking about it, I can't be held accountable. If I do the work to recognize when the gap's there, now my response is a choice. And I can choose to move towards believe the best. I'm going to do intentionally what I once did instinctively. Right? Or others will say, well, okay, this whole believe the best thing, that's good, but what about accountability? What about hard conversations? What about confrontation? What about limits and boundaries? Does this mean you can never do that? No, not at all. Not at all. What we're saying is when the gap is there, I'm going to intentionally move towards believe the best. And when I'm proven wrong, then we'll have a hard conversation. We'll confront, there'll be accountability, there'll be boundaries and limits. But when the gap is there, I'm intentionally moving towards believe the best until I've been proven wrong. They're not mutually exclusive. And the final objection. Some of you are over here and you're going, but I'm right. I'm right. The gap's there. And I assume the worst. And I'm right about what I assume. The gap is there because they were lazy or irresponsible or insensitive or thoughtless or whatever else it may be. So I'm right about, you know, assuming the worst. So why in the world would I believe the best when I'm right about the worst? And I'll give you 2 reasons why. First one's for your own sake. Because assuming the worst is stressing you out. I wish we had more time to unpack it. We don't. Gang, there's something about the posture of believe the best, there's a peace that comes with that. And there's an angst that comes when we assume the worst. It's why some of you couldn't sleep last night. It's why some of us have hemorrhoids and ulcers today, because it just winds you up. If for no other reason, for your own sake, move towards believe the best. The other reason, though, it's for the relationship. Because whether you're right or not, every time you assume the worst, you tear that relationship down. You put more distance between you and that other person. And so if you care about that relationship, you're going to choose believe the best. And you may go, I don't even care about that relationship. Be a Christian hedonist for your own sake, you know, just because it's better for you. Go with believe the best. But if you care about the relationship, it's another great reason. Doesn't matter if you're right. The price of being right is the relationship. Is it worth it to you? So, one last time. Which way do you go? The gap comes. It's gonna come. What are you gonna fill it with? Believe the best or assume the worst? Because we're all going to fill it with something. And every time we do, it tells a story about who we are. Every time we do, it either causes people to see the way that we love each other and it makes Jesus all the more compelling to them, or we fill the gap with something else and it gives them another reason to feel justified in saying no to Jesus. Every time we fill this gap, we tell people this is who we are and this is why you should follow Jesus as well. Jesus said, a new command I give you. Not an option, not a request. Jesus says, a new command. If I am following Jesus, he is commanding me to love. This is not optional. I cannot say he is my Lord. I cannot say I'm serious about following him and refuse to love. It's not an option. He says, a new command I give you, church. Love one another. And then he raises the bar. He says, as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, a desperate, dying world, everyone will know you're my disciples if you love one another. Now, as we wrap things up today, we're going to receive our offering and close in one last song. But before we do, we're going to have some time just for prayer, some time just to be quiet before God, to contemplate, to think. Something we do once a month here at Faith. And so I would encourage you, if there's something God has been doing in your life, in your heart today or this week, to spend some time over the next few minutes just talking to God about that. And if you're like, that's brand new to me, that's weird, I've never done anything like that, we'll have questions up on the screen to help you with that. Today, though, we're going to nuance this just a little bit differently. As we've been engaged in this series, we've been talking about how love does certain things. That love sees another person the way that God sees them and then lives in light of that. That love extends mercy and grace. The kind of mercy and grace I receive from God, love extends that to other people. Now, love doesn't just say things. Love does things. It's going to take action when it sees you have a need. That love is going to make sure it's doing no harm to another. That love is going to believe the best. And so during this time, I just want to challenge you. Which facet of love do you need to work on living into the most? And here's the thing. This is multidimensional. Like, there's a human dimension to this. Right? Where we have a responsibility to recognize where we need to grow and be intentional and strategic about doing that. And then there's a divine element to this as well. We need to recognize, right? Like, I can't do this. Like, I can't love like God loves, not in my power alone. But if the New Testament's telling the truth, I don't have to. Because if I'm following Jesus, then God's Spirit resides in me. And I have the ability to cry out to him and ask him to do something new and life-changing inside of me. And so as we have this time together, I want to encourage you to think about, okay, where do I need to love more? And then cry out to God to do that. And then here's where this gets different. When we have this time, we say every week, you know, hey, if we can pray for you in any way, come on up front, have a seat. One of our leaders, one of our staff will come and sit and they'll pray with you. This week, we're going to do that again. But this week, if you know where you need to love more, I want to encourage you to think about coming up and having a seat up front and sharing that with someone. There is something unique, something powerful, something different that happens when we share what God is doing in our hearts with another person and we ask them to pray for us. It's a biblical concept. And so today, you can come up here for any reason for prayer, but if God is doing a work in your heart about how you need to love, I want to encourage you, come on up front, sit down, and have somebody pray with you. So I want to invite those who are going to be praying, come on up front at this time. And then if we can pray for you in any way, please come on up front, have a seat in the front row, and we'd love to do that. And in a few minutes, we'll close things down.